Hello and welcome to Asia Matters, the podcast where we aim to go behind the headlines on the major stories affecting the world's most exciting region. I'm Andrew People. The latest major international meeting on climate change, known as COP26, has just wrapped up in Glasgow, with the 197 countries involved agreeing on rules to limit greenhouse gas emissions. But the enormous gathering's outcome has drawn plenty of criticism, particularly over the final deal's language on the use of coal, one of the world's most widely used and polluting energy sources. Asia, of course, is crucial to the debate over climate change. It's home to some of the world's biggest polluters, but also some of its fastest growing economies that are at the forefront of the world's shift to cleaner energies. So what should we make of the region's contribution to COP26? Joining me today to analyse this question are three guests. Dr. Sam Gill is the CEO of China Dialogue. It's a website devoted to understanding and analysing China's approach to tackling climate change. He's also an associate fellow at Chatham House in London. Hello to you, Sam.
Hi there, Andrew.
Dr. Tom Hale is an associate professor in public policy at the Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford University, and he specialises in the way multilateral institutions tackle global challenges. He co-leads the Net Zero Tracker, which monitors different countries and companies' progress on meeting their climate change commitments. Hello to you, Tom.
Great to be with you.
And Yan Qin joins us too. Yan Qin is the lead analyst at Refinitiv, who has over a decade's experience analysing energy and carbon markets in China and Europe. Welcome to you.
Hello, everyone.
Well, thank you so much to all three of you for joining us today, especially after such a busy time covering the COP meeting. Two of the Asian nations who made headlines during COP were, of course, China and India. In the end, both were blamed for watering down language in the final text of the meeting on coal, so that it talked of phasing down rather than phasing out coal. Sam, if I could start with you and Tom as well. Both of you were at the meeting. Is the blame being placed on both of these countries fair, and what lies behind their stance on this issue?
I think it could have been so much worse. The blame game in particular could have really dragged down the meeting. And there were points, particularly in the first week, when I did feel like we were heading for a situation that would be characterized by recriminations, particularly between the US and China, and that the possibility of any kind of progress on the actual multilateral meeting could have got completely kind of swamped with that back and forth kind of great power jostling. On coal specifically, actually the biggest thing that came out of this COP was the inclusion of the word coal, if only once, in the final text of the so-called Glasgow Climate Pact. And that's, you know, a first for a CCC text, which is kind of amazing if you think that an equivalent would be a conference about the pandemic that only mentioned SARS-CoV-2 once. I mean, it's kind of unusual that it hasn't warranted a mention until now. At least it did have that inclusion. So again, that's some progress. But clearly ambition is needed. And the, you know, US-China agreement that I think we'll probably discuss more, and I do think was something of a basis on which coal was ultimately included, is a floor, not a ceiling for ambition. And clearly it doesn't go far enough. And clearly we do start needing to talk about actually when, you know, we're going to see the end of coal. I do think the writing's on the wall for the global coal industry, but there's definitely a kind of a push and pull here and a need for greater ambition. But, you know, this process is really about ratcheting up ambition. And, you know, a ratchet doesn't just take one turn. You kind of need to come back and keep working at it in order to tighten.
Tom, you were at the meeting too. Did you come away feeling that it was a meeting that had gone well, or was there a frustration at the end about this language on coal in particular?
Well, I think there was absolutely some frustration, but also, as Sam was saying, a sense of achievement. I think it's important to put this one particular paragraph in the context of all of the changes and announcements that came out at the COP and around the COP. So we've seen, of course, Xi Jinping announcing an end to supporting coal financing abroad. That was echoed later in the G20 in October. We've had a phase-out announcements from actually big coal-using countries like Poland, South Korea, Egypt, Singapore, Chile, Ukraine, Vietnam, and even Indonesia saying it could end coal by 2040 if it had sufficient financial support. So this is in the context of a really big change, and the fact that the multilateral text is catching up with reality, the consensus document negotiated across 196 different national parties, is a useful step forward. Where I think the criticism of China and India was fair is the way that change, last minute change happened. It was definitely a power play at the end to force the vulnerable countries and the UK presidency, both of whom had pushed hard for this inclusion, to back down. That was a big sort of you can't tell us what to do moment. Where the criticism is maybe less fair is that maybe it should be referring to not just coal, but to all fossil fuels. After all, coal might be the biggest, baddest one, but the others need to follow phasing down and then out in short order. And so there might be some justifiable defense of the India and China position being, well, we should be doing them all and singling out coal, which is one that emerging economies rely on more than developed economies, is maybe a little bit unbalanced. So I think it's great it's in there as taking part of this bigger transition. And the way it happened was very much power politics move, which left a sour taste in many people's mouth.
Yanqin, to bring you in, can you explain to us why it's so difficult for China and India as well to wean themselves off coal as an energy source? And I know this is obviously a long-term issue, but how much of a role do you think the recent energy shortages in China played in its stance on this issue?
It is very difficult for these two very large countries who are relying on coal to really have very ambitious pledges now regarding phasing out coal. More than half of the energy mix of both countries are coming from coal, including power generation as well. And both are also coal-producing countries, so there are millions employed in coal industry. There are regions who their own economic growth is relying on coal industry. So they are both economic concerns, just transition concerns. They are also existing strong lobbyists. Also, in addition, for both developing countries, energy demand is still growing. So both countries will invest a lot in renewables, but at the same time as energy demand growing, so the thermal part inevitably in the near term could also grow. And so I believe this is really the wider considerations for both countries to determine their stance. But I mean, really to put a face down coal in the coal cover decision is really a historic achievement, meaning that gradually reducing coal consumption is inevitable in both countries. But then talking about the energy crunch, yes, definitely. So in China, we all know that since late September, many provinces has experienced power shortages or power rationing, and that has triggered a lot of debate domestically and also put the state planner very busy. And we also had China's National Energy Commission meeting chaired by Premier Li Keqiang in early October. So securing energy supply is a top priority among policymakers since late September, so really just ahead of the climate summit. And we also see that China's 1+N carbon peak and neutrality policy framework was actually slightly delayed to the publish because policymakers are busy with tackling the energy shortage, etc. So yes, I believe in the very near term, securing energy supply is still a top issue for the policymakers, and that will have some near-term impacts on climate policy for sure. But again, China reaffirmed in its climate pledge, China will strive to peak emissions before 2030 and carbon neutrality before 2060. So long-term pledge is still not changed. The carbon neutral pathway is the way to go.
So the long-term pledges are still there, but the short-term is still tricky. You've all referred to it already, but one of the biggest moments during the meeting was when the US and China announced this plan to work jointly on cutting greenhouse gas emissions. Sam, what were the main points of that agreement, and how binding do you think the commitments that both sides made under it really are?
It's a pretty terse agreement. It doesn't have that much substance, and it's not particularly binding. But I still think it's important. I mean, in terms of the substance that's there, there's an agreement to work together on reducing methane emissions, so an important climate warming non-CO2 gas. There's joint work on some crucial industrial challenges, green design, direct air capture of carbon, joint energy cooperation. And there's the formation of a working group between China and the United States, specifically on quote-unquote enhancing action on climate change in the 2020s. That I actually think is kind of interesting. It basically means the restarting of joint collaboration between China and the United States that first emerged after a historic 2014 agreement that really underpinned the Paris Agreement to a large extent between the US and China, which led to a lot of quite substantive joint clean energy collaboration work and so on. It's also interesting because of the framing as being about the next decade, which is really a crucial period for phasing down emissions globally and is really where both countries are going to need to focus their efforts. So there's some significance to the specifics, but ultimately it's the symbolism and the geopolitical importance of these two countries, the two largest emitters in the world by volume, coming together and agreeing to stay the course on climate diplomacy despite growing geopolitical tensions in other areas. And I do think that's incredibly important. I think it avoids great power competition drowning out the rest of the world at the COP. It provides then a kind of basis for collaborative work and for trust building between China and the United States after really bruising several years of the Trump presidency, but also the way that COVID has impacted the UNFCCC process with delays and postponements and cancellations of meetings. And, you know, in some of the most vulnerable countries, a very serious economic and, you know, debt crisis. So there was an urgent need, I think, to restore faith in multilateralism. And this is one of the things actually that paradoxically, despite it being a bilateral agreement, I think can help to create a basis to say, look, even with rising geopolitical tension, even with something that looks like a kind of a new Cold War type situation playing out, the US and China still see a common shared interest in working on an issue of planetary survival. And I think that really matters. And I thought, you know, Secretary Kerry's framing of this as, you know, in the press conference, he talked about the way that when Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev were able to meet in Reykjavik in 1986, it could form the basis of joint work on nuclear non-proliferation going forward between the Soviet Union and the United States. There is an interesting analogy here, which is basically to say that on a shared issue of planetary survival, countries will need to work together, even in context of, you know, geopolitical tensions on these sort of crucial areas, with coordination and trust building and so on built into that. And I think that's the importance of this agreement rather than necessarily the substantive elements, although, of course, I'd like to see more of those and to see those ramped up.
Tom, what was your take on this agreement? I mean, obviously, Sam referred there to John Kerry, longtime US politician, has been involved in this for many years. On the Chinese side, their negotiator Xie Jinhua similarly has been involved in the COP process for many, many years now. The worry, I suppose, is that this could be seen as a sort of last hurrah from these two aging politicians, and that this may not last beyond their sort of time in office. And at the same time, I wondered as well, Sam referred there as this being a good sign for multilateral cooperation. Do you actually think that what this bilateral agreement shows is that maybe the way forward for climate change is more of these bilateral agreements rather than big multilateral agreements where you try and get everyone in the world on the same page?
On the first question, there's no doubt in my mind that these two personalities matter hugely. John Kerry and Xie Jinhua are both, as you say, veterans of the climate process and are also people who have a lot of weight in their respective national capitals and so have access in the ear of at least a number of people in the leadership level. So this is a really important part of the process, because if you didn't have that sort of bridge, it would be much harder to make the climate issue really central to foreign policy. I noted that during Xi and Biden's Zoom summit, climate was mentioned in the readouts very cursorily from National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan as well, which also went by it quickly, but it certainly wasn't at the center of the discussions there. So I think we're, you know, likely to see a bit of a disconnect internally in both governments between the sort of foreign policy community and the climate advocates. And this is an interesting kind of bureaucratic politics dimension to watch on that front going forward. On the broader point about whether these kinds of bilateral deals are going to be central versus the multilateral process, and I think that's where we've been for a long time, actually. The UN process is now really a framework, a system of pledge and review and ratcheting that gives a context and a pathway for structuring some of the international discussions. But the actual drivers of what will change countries' ambition over time, we're going to be done increasingly at the bilateral level, at the plurilateral level, and through sub and non-state actors, companies, businesses, etc., working on these issues, increasingly through sectors as well. So I think this agreement to have a US-China working group is a very welcome step. To my mind, the big question, though, is what can be achieved actually in the next 12 months? Because one of the big outcomes from Glasgow was moving the Paris ratchet from a five-year expectation to a request, and that's the language in the text, a request for countries to reconsider their nationally determined contributions and pledges under the Paris Agreement by 2022. And so can we see an increase of China's pledge under the Paris Agreement before 2022? That's a really interesting question, and it comes back to Yen's points around the short-term energy crunch and that's interaction with climate ambition. You know, my own reading would be that there's plenty of opportunities for China to harvest some of its uncommitted progress in the form of faster than expected growth in some areas to update its NDC to move forward its peaking year, for example. I think that's very much within its gift. However, I think there's a real hesitation to move up the dial of what's been committed to internationally. I think that'll be the primary focus of the discussion in this working group going forward.
Yeah, following on from that, Yanqin, what can you say overall about China's contribution to the COP meeting? I mean, on the one hand, there was this big agreement with the US. On the other hand, there was the coal issue. There was the fact that China, I think, was absent from some of the other agreements during the meeting on methane and deforestation. What was your sense about China's whole approach to this meeting? Obviously, beforehand as well, much of the talk was about China's leader, Xi Jinping, not actually turning up to the summit. So overall, your thoughts on China's contribution?
I think without any doubt, China contributed very positively to the momentum and also sentiment, mostly in the latter half of the COP meeting. So overall, still quite positive. The atmosphere in the first part, when COP kicked off, wasn't really great. But I mean, why China's president did not turn up in person? I mean, there are COVID concerns. There's already this important part, it's 6th plenary coming up on the 8th. So yeah, I mean, as long as China has a delegation and China has heavily involved and actively involved in the negotiations, so that is China's contribution. And second is really the US-China declaration. So there are more momentum rather than more concrete measures beyond what you said, beyond the midterm and also on forestry. And the pledge on coal is exactly phasing down during the five-year plan period. So that is exactly the same as China have pledged in the April leader summit. In addition, I think there are, of course, disappointment that China did not, let's say, announce the earlier peak year. I mean, as Tom mentioned, the current energy crunch is really bringing more hesitation on China to set firm an early peak year. But it is in the discussion, and from domestic think tanks and policymakers are really doing thorough analysis of the current peak pathway. So I'm very optimistic. I believe we'll maybe see that next year. I would emphasize that, I mean, China's formally submitted its NDC before the COP, and that is enhancement compared to the previous NDC. Finally, I think in the last minute drama with phase out, phase down, this has been reported domestically and also being discussed as China's stance on representing developing countries and on the common but differentiated approach. That is, a full exit from coal has to take considering circumstances of developing countries. So that is another sign from China's negotiation stance at this time.
Tom, can I ask you too as well about your thoughts on China's contribution? Xi Jinhua, in his public comments during the meeting, talked about the fact that China, in his belief, is taking more practical action on climate change than some of the countries that make big long-term pledges. How convincing do you find that argument to be?
One quick factual point. China joined two of the major sectoral initiatives that were announced at the COP, the forest one and the hydrogen one, but not any of the others. It's an interesting question to me how China engages with these kinds of initiatives, these plurilateral, sometimes multi-stakeholder initiatives, which are, as I said, are going to be increasingly important for the implementation agenda in the multilateral process. China prefers to work usually diplomatically at the multilateral level or at the bilateral level. So this shift in form, I think, raises interesting questions about how the Chinese diplomatic engagement in climate change evolves. But on the question of whether, you know, it's better to under-promise and over-deliver or over-promise and under-deliver, I think it's definitely true that big international announcements and international pledges serve different purposes in different political systems. And say in the United States, international pledges and announcements can be a way to rally domestic support, to try to push the needle of what's possible domestically. And in the Chinese system, there's a real, I think, desire to not use international pledges to close down domestic policy space. And so I think that's the fundamental difference of how these different kinds of roles that ambition over international announcements might play. doesn't mean that I think that there's not scope to move forward here. So you again mentioned the current work going on to analyze pathways around some of the sectoral city carbonization in China through the N and the 1 plus N, and also, of course, on the potential ability to peak earlier. Those, I think, are very live conversations that can provide impetus to new sorts of announcements. It doesn't necessarily need to be put into an NDC. Any kind of clarity on the path between here and sharper emissions cuts is going to be very welcome internationally.
I think when Minister Xie makes this point about China taking practical action to combat climate change in contrast to airy promises, I think it's pretty clear that the implicit contrast he's drawing there is with the United States and the inability of the Biden administration to pass legislation on climate change before COP26. And I do think that that was casting a shadow over the discussions as much as, for example, Xi Jinping's absence that was also discussed a lot in the run-up. And, you know, I think they've got a point. I mean, you know, Biden rightly has rejoined the Paris Agreement, and it's great that the US delegation was out in force and drawing together these new, as Tom says, you know, plurinational agreements and so on around methane and the like. But in the end, you know, making ambitious agreements doesn't mean that much if you can't implement them. In fact, it doesn't mean anything if you can't implement them. And China's sort of implicit argument is, look, if we are setting out these plans and they are consistent, these pledges to the UN, and they're consistent with our five-year plan, with the direction of our industrial policy, which has very clearly sort of reoriented itself towards the creation of a low-carbon economy, you should take us seriously. And, you know, I don't think they're wrong, actually. I think it's pretty clear that for all the difficulties of implementing policy in China, and there are many, you know, China isn't a fully monolithic state by any means. There's a lot of devolution to local provinces and counties and cities, and there's protracted bargaining between elite units and the rest of it. There is, I think, an understanding at quite a high level that acting on climate change is in China's national self-interest, and that it's very aligned with other political economic goals beyond any kind of international collaboration agenda or any kind of altruistic climate change associated agenda. I think China has very clearly signaled that it's positioning itself as the leading exporter of the technologies of the future to a carbon constrained world, that it sees moving towards a low carbon economy as very consistent with moving up the value chain away from low cost, energy intensive manufacturing towards innovation and services, that it's very consistent with acting on air pollution, which is a major issue of public concern. I think all of those factors mean there's something pretty serious underlying that type of contrast that Xie and the Chinese delegation is sort of drawing to say, actually, you know, we've got now quite a concrete record of actions consistent with really systemically changing the economy and turning around that juggernaut, particularly away from coal-dominant electricity system.
I think that's absolutely right, Sam. The one question, though, I have is, you know, the intention to rebalance the economy toward a more innovation and consumption-led economy and away from an investment and export-dominated economy, not relying so much on large investments and less large infrastructure projects to maintain high growth levels. All that is absolutely the desired direction of travel. I mean, obviously critical for China's longer-term plans, and obviously would be a wonderful thing for the climate as well. But of course, it's been challenging, right, to restructure the economy in this way. There's during the COVID crisis, and we saw a lot of return to the, shall we say, turn on the taps and let the investment flow sort of model, as opposed to a gracious rebalancing model. So I think you're absolutely right, but I think there is also a real question of whether China is able to deliver this transformation. There's absolutely the intention to do it, but that's, you know, been there for decades, right? So I think this is in some ways the deeper political economy question that will have deep implications for climate transition as well.
We really are entering an era where the practicalities of implementing some of these long-term pledges are really coming home to roost. Staying on the theme of the balance between long-term pledges and the short-term practicalities, but shifting away a little bit from China to India, it's obviously one of the world's largest polluters alongside China and the US. But its leader, Narendra Modi, made headlines in the first week of the conference when he committed the country to achieving net zero emissions by 2070. That seemed like a major move. But Tom, do you think that's enough? And do you think it's achievable? Is India on the right track here?
So I think the surprise 2070 announcement from India was a very big step. It implies, even though it's 20 years later than some other countries, it's actually quite consistent with many pathways for the Paris temperature goals, and implies a much lower total contribution of emissions from India than was implied before by the model. So it's quite a significant development. Obviously, with all long-term net zero targets, the devil is in the details, especially what happens quickly. So in some ways, I think the more significant announcement India made was this large pledge on renewables. Some analysis have already shown would lead to a peaking of India's coal production in the next several years. So this is, I think, quite significant as well. And overall, the picture of net zero has really changed from sort of this was a fringe idea from scientists and activists in 2014, 2015 to really the mainstream sort of norm now, with over 90% of the world economy committed to some kind of net zero target. So India's target announcement helps solidify that. But of course, then raises the next question of how we focus attention on delivering credible action implementation, as we were just saying, that matches this long-term ambition.
Can we talk about the broader Asian region, Sam? Many of these countries, like Japan, for example, big economies, still reliant quite heavily on fossil fuels for energy. But those sorts of countries tend to go under the radar, it seems, when it comes to these major climate talks. What stood out for you in terms of the contribution of other Asian countries during this meeting?
There's a couple of big themes that come out for me in the run-up, certainly. One is the move away from financing coal overseas. That was something that was sparked by Japan and South Korea making announcements. I think it was at the Biden-hosted summit on Earth Day in April 2021, which was, of course, followed by China at the UN General Assembly in September of this year, with Xi Jinping announcing that China will no longer build coal overseas and also will finance developing countries' renewable energy systems. So I think that's a really significant commitment, actually, and is helping to sort of change the conversation on coal in a positive fashion. Otherwise, I mean, from a lot of developing Asia, the biggest demands at COP26 were clear, you know, long before the talks opened. And I don't think they were fully listened to by rich countries, frankly. There was very clear emphasis on the need for loss and damage, which is, you know, a support for those areas that cannot be adapted to and cannot be mitigated in terms of the impacts of climate change that are now going to be felt in some of the most vulnerable and affected places that also, of course, contributed the least to historic climate change emissions. Adaptation finance, progress on the $100 billion annually that was promised in 2009 initially by rich countries for the transition in the developing world, which just hasn't been realized at scale yet. The need for progress on, you know, what broadly could be called the solidarity agenda, which, you know, takes in those more technical aspects, but also more broadly links to sort of enormous inequity that COVID has exposed with, you know, vaccine inequality, enormous problems with debt crisis in the developing world. I think it was very clear that all of those issues were on the table, not only because they are absolutely pressing and very urgent, but also because they're really sorely needed now strategically if you want to restore faith in multilateralism in those countries. And I think for a lot of Asian countries like Bangladesh and so on, it was very clear that that's where they stood and what they sort of needed from COP26. This wasn't a Paris or Copenhagen where there's a sort of pass or fail at the end. People's definitions of success at COP26 sort of differed in terms of where they, or, you know, what position they were coming to the talks from. And for a lot of countries, I think it was really seeing reassurance that those crucial concerns were being taken seriously. And, you know, there was some progress there. All of those issues did at least get reflected in the final kind of pact. There were some interesting movement towards fulfilling some of these finance goals and so on, but it didn't go far enough. And I do actually think that there's a real moral incumbency on rich countries to go further and to show greater solidarity in understanding how disparate and unequal the effects of climate change are going to be globally.
Yanqin, what's your sense of whether richer countries in Asia, Japan, Korea, even China itself, which is, you know, the world's second largest economy now, do you see them stepping up in terms of offering the assistance needed by smaller nations to cut emissions and also to adapt to the effects of climate change?
You know, I definitely see that. I mean, I've discussed China's stance at COP26, and one point is really on financing. I mean, China's climate envoy, Xie Zhenhua, even before COP26, when he describes China's position and what China won't achieve, he really stressed financing. And China being the largest developing country, actually, I mean, I believe we are really slowly passing the developing stage. So it is important for China to lead the financing and also providing assistances for the other developing countries in Asia to transit their energy system and transit their economy.
Tom, Obviously, on Asia Matters, we look at the broader region. To what extent, when it comes to climate change, can we actually talk about Asia as a region that talks with one voice in any sense, or is it just simply too diverse? On the other hand, is there a particular country, do you think, that's emerging as a leader of Asia when it comes to climate change? Obviously, we have the European Union and we have the US as well as other major blocks here. Can I just get your thoughts on that, please?
I think it is indeed very diverse. And we saw some of the intra-Asian diversity on display in the dramatic moments in the last plenary at the COP where India and China were moving from phase out to phase down for coal. And that was sharply criticized by some of the Pacific Island states, for example. And so, of course, there's a multitude of views. One interesting prospect that I'm curious about looking forward, though, is to what extent will we see some of the potent cross-border investment across Asia address these questions around transition much more fully. One of the most surprising things I saw, or exciting things really, to come out of the COP was this deal between South Africa, the power producer in South Africa, which is very coal-based, and a number of Western countries around a transition plan for South African coal phase down, $8 billion plan. Now, could we imagine something like that taking place through BRI or through some of the other financing mechanisms that are so important for knitting together the Asian economy? I think these are some really fascinating questions that we're not there yet on, but that's where I would imagine some sort of cross-regional solidarity, if you will, might emerge.
Sam, could I ask you to follow up on that?
I think there might be a difference between the way that Asian countries, particularly some of the sort of larger powers in the region, operate in the context of the UNFCCC talks and actually how the transition is playing out across Asia. On the latter, I think there's really interesting things happening, particularly with regard to the role that renewables can play in really transforming development outcomes in some poorer countries. And there, I think we're going to see, as you know, in a lot of places in the world, a really interesting, probably quite competitive dynamic playing out over who gets to build and finance the next generation of infrastructure that will be needed to, in many cases, kind of leapfrog towards modern energy systems and better development outcomes in poorer countries. In Southeast Asia, for example, in the Lower Mekong Basin, you've had for a long time sort of big regional economic initiatives, often financed by countries like Japan, in frameworks like the Greater Mekong Subregion. In recent years, you've seen a really strong challenge to that from China through the Belt and Road Initiative, often actually in the context of local areas, also through other regional development initiatives, things like the Lansang Mekong Cooperative Framework. And increasingly, those are going to shift towards financing renewables and clean technologies as an aspect of growth. And I think we'll see a kind of a changing role for countries in Southeast Asia in particular to ask for new models of investment, ask for new models of growth from financiers, and ideally healthy competition between countries and sort of blocks and regional financiers like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank or the Asia Development Bank in terms of who gets to finance that sort of technology of the future that's going to be needed. So I do think there's a really important role when it comes to energy, climate, food, you know, all of the sort of different aspects of the transition, transportation as well, how they play out across Asia.
I think that point about competition versus or alongside cooperation on climate change is very interesting. Yanqin, we've seen China emerge as a leader in many areas of renewable energy in recent years. It's a major, well, the world's leading producer of solar panels and wind turbines. What about the Asian region more broadly, as well as China? Do you see that countries are investing in these sorts of new, cleaner technologies and companies as well that operate in these sorts of areas that can help hasten the world's shift to cleaner energy?
Yeah, we all know China really dominates global solar and wind value chain, and you're also leading many green technologies, as you mentioned. Of course, I mean, in essence, it's industry competition. And this competition brings down costs for these new low-carbon technologies. Solar panel and wind turbine, their costs have been falling, and that is making it economically viable for more countries shifting to the clean energy. So, yeah, I mean, economy drives many decision-making. So investing in new technologies into green transition, that will drive down the costs and that will make the path more smoother. And also with China and also broadly Asia is very important in terms of manufacturing industry. So, I mean, that's where growth lies. So I believe that even in the new pathway to a net zero world, to more investment in new technologies in Asian region. That is both beneficial for Asia and also benefit for the whole world.
And Yanqin, did you see much progress at COP26 towards the establishment of carbon markets around the world? What were your thoughts on developments there?
I'm a carbon market analyst as myself, really extremely happy about Article 6. So now we have rules for global carbon market so that countries can use such kind of trade to help achieve their own NDCs. And importantly, the new rules for global carbon trading also helping for enterprises who are seeking to achieve corporate carbon reduction targets. But of course, it's important to avoid the greenwashing. So the rules already include some quite important requirements and safeguarding to prevent double counting. In my view, I think Article 6 being achieved is very solid and ensures integrity by preventing this type of loopholes. The adopted text also creates a new carbon crediting mechanism. So, I mean, I call it CDM version 2. So this definitely will inject fresh momentum among global carbon trading, new carbon markets, and these carbon markets will include both the ETS, compulsory markets, and also the voluntary carbon market and also offsetting. But finally, again, it's important to maintain the rules to make them solid and integrity and ensure additionality of the projects.
Thank you for that. And thank you to all three of our guests today. Some really valuable insights into the meeting itself, but also the remaining challenges that, of course, the world faces and that many countries in Asia face in terms of the climate change agenda. So thank you so much, Sam, Tom, and Yanqin, for your time today. That's all from us for this episode. You can always get in touch with us. We have a Twitter account at Asia Matters Pod. We have a email account. It's asiamatterspod@gmail.com. We're starting to publish some transcripts of the podcast, so you can visit our website as well to see those and to get more information about the episodes that we've been doing. Thank you again for listening. Thank you to Rebecca Bailey and Zirak Hurum for producing this episode. Thank you to Alex DeStrange for doing the music for Asia Matters. And thank you most of all, as I say, to you, our audience, for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and please tune in for more insights in the future. Thank you and goodbye.